Hi, this is On the Podium on the BBC World Service.
I'm comedian Eliza Skinner, and this is where Olympic and Paralympic champions lift the lid on what it takes to be on top of the world. U.S. Paralympian Scout Bassett is here with me, making up for my lack of athleticism. Hey, Scout.
Hey, Eliza.
Do you train every single day, or do you get days off?
Almost every day, 5 to 6 days a week, and usually Sundays are our rest days, so not quite every day. As much as my coach or people think athletes are machines, they are not. So you do need to take a rest day here and there.
A little time for recovery.
Absolutely.
But you're just thinking about it the whole time, right? Even when you're resting, you're like,
yes,
going through it in your head.
Or like I'm sitting on my couch and I feel like I should be doing something because I'm just not comfortable just sitting still. But I think that's just my natural state anyways. I don't sit still very well. So the rest days don't really feel all that restful.
Yeah, that's how I am with crafting. If I'm not knitting, I'm like, oh boy, time to get back in the game. The third member of the podium team is the BBC's Ed Harry. What about you, Ed? Are you down at the gym every day?
No, I'm not.
You're not commenting on other people working out every day?
Well, there's an element of that, not in that quite that creepy fashion, but I definitely have to train my voice. I do train my eye because there's a sort of speed of thought required in all of this. So that is really important. And there's exercises that I still do, verbal exercises and things. I tell you what, this is one of the first ones I ever got told to do, because you can feel very self-conscious commentating on the radio. You think, who am I talking to? Who's hearing this? What if I just go, or repeat myself or have nothing to say and there's just dead air, which is the anxiety dream.
Yes, I know the feeling, Ed. I know the feeling.
It's like, well, I suppose it's like, what if they don't laugh when I tell a joke? But in the context of, you know, do people think there's something wrong with the radio if I just stop? So a long time ago, I was told, you're driving a lot doing this job. As you drive between and around following this particular team, look at the clock in your car, think about the time, and then just commentate on what you can see. Drive down that road. Tell me how many lampposts there are. Tell me the color of the car to the inside. Tell me how fast you think the guy to the outside just went and whether he or she is breaking the speed limit. And then he said, keep going and keep going and keep going until you can't talk anymore. And then see how many minutes you did. Have a rest. And then next time, see how much longer you can go for.
Wow.
That's how I learned to freestyle rap. Which sounds ridiculous, but is actually true. I would do the same thing. Anything you see what you can do with it. So Scout, on the days that you are training, what are we talking?
The days are, so I count training as from the minute that I leave the door to the minute that I come back home. Because the drive, going to physio, seeing the trainer, that's all part of training, even if you're not actually working out, but that's all part of the process of being an athlete.
See, this is the kind of mindset I can use. Yes, I'm driving. That counts as working out. I love it.
So 2 to 3 workouts a day, and all in all, about 5 to 7 hours from when I leave home to when I come back. It's a lot of work. And usually I eat like a light breakfast. In fact, it was kind of funny because the other day, I don't know if he's going to appreciate me sharing this, but a teammate of mine, I will not say his name, we were doing some repeat 300s. And, you know, of course, he wasn't feeling well after like 2 of them. And he finds his little spot. And I was like, oh, you had bacon and eggs for this morning, didn't you? He's like, how'd you know? I'm like, I see it all. Yeah. I saw exactly what he had for breakfast.
I remember working with an athlete, like an NFL football player, teaching him how to rap. It's a weird career I have. And at one point, he just sort of like looked up suddenly and was like, I have to eat right now. And I was like, wow, this guy knows his body in a way that is so foreign to me. It's so different. Like, I'm like, maybe sometime I should eat today.
Yeah, we're like clockwork, right? Everything, part of being an athlete is being super habitual, super regimented. And even my day-to-day like diet really doesn't vary all that much because I know what works. I know what I like. I know what will stay down inside of me, and which is really the most important part. And but we're just it. That's very normal, just to be like clockwork. You know, everything on a time system. But I'm curious, like, do you actually rap?
Yeah, I don't do it professionally. I don't put anything out.
Don't you think, Ed, we need to hear this?
Yeah.
Yeah, I should stop mentioning it because you guys are going to make me do it at some point. But yeah, yeah.
Yes. I think maybe Eliza needs to record a little rap thing and make it our, like, intro music, intro rap.
I mean, the BBC is much classier than my janky rapping.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it's the BBC's vibe. But I really am down for that idea.
I don't know, let's just do the show right here. That could be like the season finale. That could be
yes. Or yes, or you could do it for the season finale.
All right, you guys build a beat.
Oh gosh.
If you guys can build a beat for me, then I'll rap.
Ed and I will collaborate. We'll work on it. We'll have some practice sessions and get it down, and then
there's the challenge.
We'll have it ready for you.
Perfect. Okay. I'll wait for that day. All right, well, I think it's time to introduce our guest, Ed.
Okay, joining us today, a gold medal winning rower from London 2012 in the men's lightweight coxless four. Four men in a boat who won South Africa's first ever Olympic gold in rowing. Our guest is the only member of that quartet who's black. His route onto the water, into his first boat, and finally onto the biggest stage of all was unlike anybody else's at that time. He showed what was possible. Sizwe Unlovu, welcome. You are on the podium.
Thank you very much, Ed. It's good to be here.
So, Sizwe, we are so excited to have you. We've actually dug up a few photos from your past and your career. Let's take a look at one of them. Ed, what do you got?
This image is our guest's greatest sporting achievement, and Sizwe's is his podium moment at the London 2012 Olympic Games. The lake at Eton Dorney is in the background, as are the Olympic rings, and we're looking at the winning four. Medals newly placed around their necks, bouquets in their hands, arms round each other's shoulders, standing as one. Even now, Sizwe, the best part of what, 9 years later, what emotions does that moment still stir within you?
I get a lot of goosebumps. I still get excited also till this day. I think from this day, that day onwards, everything I think in life's changed. I was the first black in Africa, I don't know, in the world to win a gold medal in the sport of rowing. So yeah, it still gives me goosebumps. I mean, the night before I couldn't sleep, being nervous and worried about, am I going to be able to hold the boat in the middle of the course? That was my job, to make sure we're in the middle of the lane and don't lose the boys with the rhythm.
Were you aware, or do you appreciate the significance of that gold medal and what it meant for your country? Tell us a little bit about the emotions of that gold medal.
Well, certainly, yeah, it meant a lot. I think, I'll be honest, in the beginning, I didn't think it would change life as much as it changed right now. Because I think for me, it was, I've just won an Olympic medal, or another race. It wouldn't have sinked in, because while I was still in London, we finished the race. I was running around and going to BBC World, I'm going to that, I'm going to that. Tea for free, beers for free, all of that stuff. It only sank in when I got back home. When you arrive at the airport, the whole nation is there. The media, you were just put in the Blue Lights Brigade. The next thing, you were going to schools. The next thing, you were talking to corporates. I think 6 months later, when things settled down, that is when then I realized that, you know, you've done something bigger than I thought it was. Olympic medal. And you were the hero. Till today, sometimes I sit there and bite myself, like, how did I do that? How did we do that?
Not an experience a lot of people have.
Yes. So yeah, it excites me. I'm so happy today. You know, sometimes I look in the mirror and I smile to myself. Okay. You know, you walk around up with kids today. I mean, my students today, they coach at university. They now and then remind me, like, you know, when they need issues or they've got something, you need to help them out. you know, like, sees you're an Olympic gold medal, you can do this, you know, everyone knows you. Come on, sees, you can do this.
You so, got superpowers.
Yeah. Well, before you won gold in 2012, your team did not qualify in 2008 for the Olympics, and you suffered a personal loss during that time. Did that provide you some fuel, or, you know, as you were nearing 2012, did you fear like maybe this the same thing was going to happen again?
In 2007, obviously, there was a year for us to qualify for Olympics, 2000 for Beijing. And while that happened, I got sick. My roommate, which is Bruce Tevye at the time, he got sick for me. He got my bronchitis. We both had bronchitis. And then we were sent back home. So at that same time, 2007, I got back. I then had lost my dad. And so I was not in the right state of mind. And so it didn't work out. And in 2008, I then lost my mother again at the same time. From then onwards, I took a break and I thought that would be it for me. Try this thing. I've been rowing since 1997 from school. Olympics aren't going to happen for me. So I left, took a break, lost both the parents. I need to have food. Rowing wasn't getting paid to row. It was a choice, you know, to row. So no way in getting paid. So I took a break, found a job. I joined the police force. And then just end of 2008, I think in the beginning of 2009, Roger Barrow, the national coach, called me and said, "Hey, Suzwe." And he's like, "What are you doing?" I told him what I was doing. And he's, "How much are you earning?" I told him, he's like, "Okay, listen, you can come back to rowing. We'll look after you. What you're earning now, we'll replace it. The Federation will find some source of money, you know, and try and support you. All you all have to do is just train, eat, sleep, and recover." And that was, for me, that was, okay, now you're talking to me. Because previously, we were just juggling things around. And the guys that I was rowing with that we didn't qualify with, they all retired, then started selection process, started to build the four together. And yeah, it was tough in the beginning. And slowly, slowly, things got better. And in 2011, I had an injury then, so someone else was in the boat. So right up until 2011, I had not been in the boat. I had an operation on my right wrist. So there were just ups and downs that were going. So I just lost two parents and there was injuries.
So was that like 2 years that you weren't in a boat?
Yes, almost 2 years. So wow. I was, while everyone was celebrating, I think half of my teammates were celebrating their qualifications. At the time, I was training because I needed to obviously fight for my spot back in the boat. There were five of us and only four was going to Olympics. So that I then had to make sure that I tick everything correctly in the box and make sure I was in the top two. And that's where we started. And the rest was history.
Yeah. So when you're training for a sport like this, where you're working so closely with three other people in a boat, how much time are you spending with them? Are you just like together all the time? Are you getting sick of each other? What's it like?
It was part of the process. So we got sick of each other. But I think we had ways of dealing with it. Communication was the key, open communication. But so we spent a lot of time, obviously, in training. And camps were even worse. That's where we got sick of each other. I mean, when we trained in the boat, it wasn't just the four. So we trained in pairs. Also, the pairs will stay in 1 week with one person, the next week with that person. Maybe the first week I would stay with John. James will stay with Matthew. Then the next week, Matthew will swap. One, I'll have John. Matthew will have James. So that kept things a bit better than it would be. Imagine staying 3 weeks on a camp with the same person in the same space. It gets a bit too much. But as I said, communication was important. Quite often, we would have those meetings every weekend just to chat about things that irritated about others. Yeah, so...
like counseling?
So, I mean, it does sound like counseling, but we had our team support. When I say team support, we had the coach, we had the physio, everyone there. So we just sit around the table. Everything would be on the table. If it was not on the table, allowed to talk about it after the meeting. So that's how we dealt with things. But we had a common goal, obviously, to get to Olympics. Wanting to win Olympics. Yes, we didn't know whether we were going to win or not, but that was the plan. So that helped just so that we could understand each other and also to build a bit of trust.
I'm just wondering, how often do you and the national team coach at that time reflect on the fact that if he hadn't have come to you and said, look, pretty much I want you to be, I suppose, a foundation stone in a young squad, if he hadn't have drawn you back in, I mean, how often do you let yourself think of how your life may have played out, for which, for very good reasons, if you described, no one would have thought any less of you if you had said in 2009, I'm not going back to that again.
Yeah, true. I mean, I've had this thought so many times, like, what would have happened if I never went back to Tunis? In fact, I go as far as back to school because I got into Rain with the help of the late Mr. Tom Price, was my headmaster at school. I guess, I mean, you probably saw something that, like Tom Price, you know, he saw something in me.
What do you think he saw?
Okay, for Mr. Price, I would say he didn't see a rower. He probably saw a young boy who needed direction and just guided me in the right direction. And when I met Mr. Price, things had changed. You got me to rowing. And when I told him I'm doing this, I need to go work after school. Okay, I need you to rowing. Don't worry about that. We'll sort that out. I didn't have to pay for school fees. I had to make boat go faster, the right direction at school. So I then found a new family.
When you were growing up in South Africa, there was still under apartheid, right?
Yeah, so where I grew up, it was still under apartheid. It came up of apartheid 1994, I think. Yeah. So I joined the white schools, so the co-ed schools or the multiracial schools in 95. That was my first time. For me, it was still early days. There was still that break, you know. So when you were walking with a white, when you're seen with a white person in the street, it was sort of a traitor or sort of, you know, like white people all look at you funny when you were walking with a white person. Black people were like, ooh, okay. Big shock, or maybe more of a surprise. I was a bit nervous. I wasn't in a comfortable zone. I mean, also when I joined the rowing squad at that time, also the Surrey rowing fraternity was still a bit more white than anything.
So, what kind of changes? I mean, besides you're starting to go to a white school. What other changes do you remember affecting your life during that time?
For me, it was quite a lot because I grew up in Mpumalanga and I grew up speaking Zulu, and our first language we were forced at school was Afrikaans. So when I moved to Joburg, it was an English school. Well, it was a challenge for me to get into that school, but because my mother was a domestic worker, but the employer had fought for me to get into that school, saying my mother works in this area and she stays with them. So firstly, it was the language barrier, never mind the color thing and still the early days, but the language barrier. Was hard.
That sounds very isolating, not like
yes.
Looking different, not being able to speak as easily with everybody else. Yeah, it sounds lonely.
That's how I felt basically at school. I think, as I say, rowing was it's a small sport and it's more, there's communities also was together. So when I started rowing at school, it was, I think I enjoyed it more because it got me away from school. I mean, I was happy to be in a white school and multiracial, co-ed boys and girls, but the language was the problem. I couldn't speak English like we speak it now. I was struggling. And my mother was just knew the basics. So if I had homework from school, she couldn't help me. But I had white friends. And, you know, I was struggling to ask them, hey, explain this to me. So you would need to ask someone who speaks English well, who speaks Zulu, to explain it in English for me and also explain it in Zulu. So I felt isolated. Then when I got into rowing, I sort of felt there was a family and everyone was nice. It was welcoming. There was no space for racism. Yes, there were obviously misunderstandings and all those arguments and fights, small little things. But there was no racism, I wouldn't lie. So I felt I found a family where I belonged. We made jokes, we laughed. It took me out of a dark hole, basically. I think that's where rowing took me out. It just took me out of that. And for as long as I was rowing, I'd say to myself, I don't want to go back into where I was before. When I got to rowing, I was exposed into a whole lot of opportunities. I met different people. And the people I met along the way, they were very nice. They were genuinely nice people.
Let's go back before you went to the school. Can you take us back to your childhood and paint for us a picture of your life and talk a little bit about some of those things that occurred during your childhood?
I was born in Johannesburg. I stayed there. Well, I stayed with my mother, who was working. I think he had been with the employer 25 years. So when I was born, she was staying with the employer. And then I had to go and live with my grandparents. Life was tough, obviously, not living with your mother, your father. You're living with your grandparents. You start at a very young age to do house chores, everything. The school was 20 k's away. I had to walk to school. And you had to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. You get home, you go to go get water, pushing a wheelbarrow with 225 liters to go get water. And I've got to cook because my grandmother was at work, so I'd come back. So it was tough. But at that time, there was school, it's a corporal punishment. So if you were late at school, you get a beating. You were not allowed to be late. So if your homework was not done, you were not allowed to, you'd be punished. I mean, at that time, I thought it was normal. There was no electricity. To wash your own clothing. That was sort of the lifestyle until I moved to Johannesburg, end of 94, the year where I met the Tom Price. Also then to get into Mount Yu High School was a struggle. They made me write the aptitude test. Till this day, I don't know how I passed the test because it was a life change. As I said, I never wanted to go back where I came from. When you finish matric in those areas, there's nothing. It's done for you. You go find a job. Again, the question that you asked earlier on, where would I be if I didn't come back and rank in 2009? My question was, where would I be if I didn't decide at the age of 14 to say, Mom, I don't want to go back. Where would I be if she had said, no, go back and go back to school? Life would have been different. Would I still be alive? Would I be doing drugs on the street? You know, so life is still obviously tough in those areas with obviously job securities and all that stuff.
You talk about your childhood and how during that chapter, through those hardships and struggles, you learned a lot of critical life lessons. Can you tell us how those experiences and your childhood really built you or what you learned about yourself having gone through that?
Yeah, I think it built many ways because, I mean, if I had to live my life again and go back, I don't think I would change it. Mm. I think if I was given everything in a silver spoon, I wouldn't have learned that you needed to work for what you want or what you want to achieve. You learn lessons more from your losses or from the tough upbringing. You learn a lot from those where, other than being spoiled kid, being given everything in a box, you ask, you get given. Yeah, so I don't know if I answer your question.
That's a great answer.
it's taught me a lot in life.
It sounds like those early experiences and the lessons and the things that you went through really laid the foundations for who you are now and really a driving force for your accomplishments.
I think it teaches you to respect others as well. After winning an Olympic medal, it's just like I still stayed being myself. I mean, I've seen a lot of people change and forget where you come from and then they become different people. So I think those are the lessons I've learned. Okay. I can leave the worst in life and also I need to come back and be here. And you need to balance the two. So you can't now forget about where you're coming from and disrespect those who raised you because they don't have the money, they don't have all of this stuff.
This is On the Podium with me, Eliza Skinner, Scout Bassett, and Ed Harry.
Our guest today is South African Olympic gold medalist Sizwe Ndlovu. And time to move on to another photo, Ed.
Well, this is a picture. It's a more youthful picture. It's pretty similar to the podium image. There's still a lake behind the guys. There's still four rowers. They've got their shirts off this time. They've got their arms around each other's shoulders again. But in this is a picture in which all four rowers have bleached their hair. Sizwe, why did you all bleach your hair?
Whoa.
Is that a look that lasted?
Very beachy.
Oh, I wonder where you guys get these pictures.
We do investigative research.
Wow. Oh, this goes back to 1999. Wow, that was my third year of Ray. We were in a junior national squad there, and that's where the dream started for me. So yeah, this picture goes back to that time. I'm surprised you got it, guys.
Can you tell us why you colored your hair?
By the I remember we were on rowing camp just before we left for the tour. And it was for fun. It was just something all decided. We're going to have the same thing for the crew. We're going to peroxide over her. That's the result of that. No, it was fun. I was famous in Belgium. Not in Belgium, in Bulgaria. It was still my first, my second trip overseas. But I was the only black person and at the airport and the area that we were staying. We stayed at a university. So I was even scared to walk out in the street by myself. I had kids that just would come to you. I mean, in the street walking, they'll come to you and pinch you. Like, they'll pull your skin. Want to see, are you real? Are you a human?
So you were the ambassador, not just for South Africa, right, but for black people.
Yes, I was nervous. I was actually scared at some stage. So I think I was scared people would stare at you. So I was, I don't know, whether they've never seen a black person, but, and I was still young at that time. I'm from South Africa and knew nothing. So yeah, well, early memories.
I think we get quite lazy in the media talking about people going on a journey or get someone to talk to us about the journey that they've been on. But everything you've described, living through a period of transformation in your country, all of the false starts and the comebacks and everything else. I mean, the gold medal, I suppose, is the amazing cherry on the cake of all of this. How do you seek to use that gold medal and the fact you topped that podium? How do you, what is it, best part of 9 years later, try and find the next Sizwe or the next young woman that's going to do what you did? How active are you in trying to use what you got at 2012 to find the next wave?
I mean, after 2012, I was happy to see the numbers at schools had increased at the under 14 level. There were more black people joining the sport of rowing in all the private schools and the government schools that we have. And I understand rowing is a very costly sport, so you need a boat, you need water access. Yes, now I'm happy compared to where we were before. The numbers have increased. And right now in a space where I'm as a manager and coach of University of Johannesburg, that's my platform, my recruit form. I go to schools and internship and look for talent and, you know, and pull from the talent. So the challenge is just equipment. It's access to water. Not all the towns have water access. Not everyone you can get, but the numbers have changed and it's good to see that.
Thank you so much for giving us so much of your time and telling us so much about your life. It's been really great having you on the show. We wish you the best.
Thank you, guys. It's been awesome. Sorry I was late. Oh, it's 9 o'clock, so it was over an hour. Hours, obviously, when you're enjoying yourself. So thank you so much.
I mean, I feel like that's pretty much everybody's story, right? That's who didn't go through all of that and then get a gold medal, right?
A lot to unpack there.
Yeah, but every time we would ask a little bit more, then Sizwe would tell us a little bit more. But it wasn't as if he came along and said, I won my gold medal because of these things or despite these things. It was kind of, well, since you've asked me, yeah. I mean, those kilometers there and back, but when he was living in the township and going to school, that's almost a marathon there and back when you add those two 20Ks together every day. And if you're late, you're going to get a beating from one end of that journey or the other. I'm also aware that it's recent history, but when you say, you know, the end of apartheid in South Africa, there are lots of videos of Nelson Mandela on the long walk to freedom and everything else. But what if you actually lived through that? What if it was changing around you, but it hadn't all changed yet? And he found a sport and he found key people all along the way who welcomed him in what was, yeah, something that I suppose in the end he took in his stride, but not many ordinary people can just take these things in their stride, I don't think.
Yeah, I also found it really interesting that he ended up in a sport that is where you're so connected with other people as a team after having spent so many different parts of his life being isolated in different ways. And having to be on his own and think on his own.
I felt so connected to his story, not because we've necessarily had the same journey or path, but shared experiences of, you know, he talks a lot about being in places and spaces where he was the outsider And that was certainly true of how I grew up and even in sport. And it takes a tremendous amount of personal strength and willpower and just mental stamina to just simply even exist in those places, you know, where you know that you're the outsider, you're the different one, you're, you know, him coming to a place where he didn't speak the language and me coming to America from China and not having spoken any English. And I can tell you, for people that have not lived somewhere else or outside of their homeland, that that language barrier, that initial assimilation process, so to speak, or acculturation process, is just the most gut-wrenching experience, right? How we connect with people is so much about language and identity and experiences. And when you're somebody that has such a different one, it's really, really hard to connect, to relate. And like you said, Eliza, so much of, you know, I definitely connected with his isolation, feeling alone experience, because that was very much my childhood also. But also the other thing I really thought was interesting, and just another parallel, was him, their team not qualifying in 2008 and coming back another 4 years later and making that London Olympic Games. And I failed to make my first Paralympic team, and just the personal, you know, journey that it takes to so many people. I think people would be surprised by how many athletes fail to qualify for a games and don't try again. That's it. That's the end of the road.
Yeah. It's interesting. In what I do, I see a lot of people who, you know, don't get some big comedy showcase or some big comedy job the first time, and then think, well, they didn't want me. I must not be their cup of tea, or maybe I'm not good enough.
Or that was a sign. Yeah.
Yeah. Or that was a sign. And mm-hmm. so much of even what I do is just, all right, keep going, learn from this and work harder. And, don't take no for an answer.
And there was no free pass, was there? That when this national team coach said, I want you to be, you've been the young guy in an older squad, now you've got to be the older guy with youngsters all around you. But that wasn't to say, and I promise you that in this many years' time, you'll be at the Olympics, because being allowed to sit in one of those seats on the boat, the selection process is absolutely brutal. So, you know, yes, he had a roof over his head. Yes, financially, they made it make sense for him, but he still had to go through that whole process. It wasn't a film script. It sounds like one, but the more he described it, there were so many ups and downs and brick walls. And just something else completely an aside, something very different, but I don't know about you, and this doesn't happen where I work these days, I'm very pleased to say, but offices, spaces you share with others, are full of cliques. They're full of little groups that do their own thing. Wasn't it fantastic that when there's only four of you, they rotate who rooms with who? So I room with him 1 week, and then the next week we swap and I room with him. Because if we're going to do this, we've got to be a unit, and we can't afford to have these two moaning about those two when they go back to their room at night. I just thought, in terms of how you manage people and manage problems and try and build, like you said, build trust, just so simple, but so brilliant and easy to do. Let's all sit next to somebody else tomorrow, and then we won't get like that, hopefully, you know.
Yeah, I loved the, like, we have these sessions where we put everything out on the table, and if you don't put it out on the table, it's done. It's so smart. And I think things, you know, people think training for a sport is all about running and lifting weights, not about interpersonal management.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really great point. And something else that I thought he touched on that I think can be applicable to so many people is, you know, he talked about how his childhood and those experiences and how that built him and the lessons he learned. But I loved that when he included that winning gold at the Olympics, that he was still able to be grounded and humbled from his experiences, right? And I think that's a wonderful thing, because there's so many people where, you know, you can go through an experience like that and you can be bitter and angry and feel like, you know, you were dealt a bad hand. And then, you know, to maybe in his case to experience success, and then suddenly it's like, oh, that never happened. You know, those experiences, those things never happen. And I just really like that he took that and something so difficult and has used it for good, and said, you know, I'm still going to be the same person that, you know, had to walk 20 kilometers to go to school and back, you know, each way. I think that's a quality that is just very refreshing to see for somebody that's experienced tremendous success in sport also.
I mean, isn't everybody who they were when they were a kid, they're either fighting it or accepting it. And it seems like he's accepted it and used it.
And the way he gets along with his students, and I love the fact that can't you help? You're a gold medalist. Almost like, come on. I love that sort of, you know, it's yeah. there's a yeah. great respect in doing that, but there's also a really great kind of cheekiness that he obviously appreciates. But it's sort of, because it's a compliment. It's a compliment whichever way you say it. But, you know, can you help me with this? Because you're a gold medalist, so, you know, special powers, presumably.
That's it from us. You can head online and see the photos we've been talking about. Just search for BBC Podium. Next time, Scout Bassett, Ed Harry, and myself, Eliza Skinner, will be joined up on the podium by another very special guest.
You don't want to lose that passion. I definitely don't want to screw this up. I've seen so many people just come and go because they get pushed too hard.
We'll broadside, kickflip, and ollie with skateboarder Brighton Zuner.
That's next time on the podium.